he visited Philadelphia to address the World Affairs Council, which on September 19th will have Ted Hesburgh, the president of Notre Dame, to lecture on nuclear issues. For more information on Ted Hesburgh's talk, you can call the World Affairs Council at 563-5363. This is Fresh Air on 91 FM. Dr. Ikle, who we just heard from, was one of the strategists mentioned in Fred Kaplan's new book, The Wizards of Armageddon, the story of America's intellectual strategic community, the men who through military and university think tanks have shaped America's nuclear weapons doctrine and nuclear warfighting strategy. These defense intellectuals, as Kaplan refers to them, are virtually unknown to lay people. The Wizards of Armageddon is about the men who have formed our nuclear philosophy and about the shape our nuclear strategy has taken since we dropped two atom bombs on Japan in World War II. Fred Kaplan writes regularly about defense issues for the Boston Globe. He contributed to their special supplement on war and peace in the nuclear age, which won a Pulitzer Prize in 1982. Fred Kaplan is my guest. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
At the conclusion of Dr. Ikle's comments, he brought up the idea that people view nuclear strategists as being cold-blooded because they deal with such an unthinkable issue. You've interviewed about 200 nuclear strategists for your book. Do you believe that they're cold-blooded?
Well, let me just recall a phrase that Herman Kahn, who was referred to, wrote in his 1960 book on thermonuclear war, in which he said that one of the things that he was trying to do was to create a vocabulary that would allow people to discuss these kinds of issues in a very cool and unemotional way. If these people are not cold-blooded, I think they, Dr. Ikle's comments notwithstanding, go out of their way to try to become cold-blooded. It becomes almost a sign of seriousness and a sign of respectability that, yes, I can look into the hideous maelstrom of the fireball, you know, and be cool about it and not get shaken by it and not, you know, start talking about how many millions of people will get killed by this, but instead to talk about it almost as if it's a chess game. Now, I agree with Dr. Ikle that, you know, unpleasant things have to be thought about. People should think about these things and should indeed think about them in a cool, rational manner. However, I think that what's happened over the last 20, 25, 30 years is that this rather small and quite insular group of strategists have dealt with the issue for so long that they've become rather jaded and that they their theories about nuclear warfighting and nuclear deterrence have been around for so long that they don't really examine the fundamentals anymore. They almost forget that what they're talking about are just theories, that there's nothing in the real world that necessarily substantiates their validity in 1983 any more than there was in 1953 or 47 when they were first dreamt up. And I think the danger of this is that they've been around for so long that they've come to accept them as almost a scientifically tangible reality. And if there is a big crisis in the coming years, they might feel tempted to try to execute some of these theories, to test them, so to speak, because they've forgotten just how abstract they are.
And you think that that distancing from the real effects of nuclear weapons is both a function of the language that they've used and from having worked with it for so long?
Yeah, the language is it serves two functions. One, it makes it seem to the non-expert that these issues are, well, they're just completely beyond me. I mean, I'm worried and concerned, but Jesus, I don't understand what they're talking about, and so I'm going to leave it to them. They seem to be quite smart, and many of them are quite smart. So it's a way of keeping non-experts out of the realm of the experts, which is also a way of keeping them in power. The one reason why a man like Fred Ikle has been around for such a long time is that, well, hey, Fred's been around. He's an expert. He knows the field. He knows how to do the calculations, that sort of thing. And second, it provides a certain psychological function. I mean, these people do think about this all day long, day after day, year after year. If they really had to confront, even on a weekly basis, the hideousness of the subject that they're engrossed in, it would become psychologically intolerable. And so one of the questions that you asked him and what was something about, you know, how does one react to this? And he reacted like he didn't quite understand your question. And one thing that I found in talking with many of these people is that it's just not the kind of question you bring up. You know, like, well, what about the morality of this? Or what about how do you sleep at night or something like that? As soon as you ask a question like that, the person, if he's been in this a long time, will come to the conclusion that you're a real outsider and you don't really understand the subtleties of this field at all. And so it's almost, you're proclaiming your amateurishness even by asking a question like that. And so the vocabulary and the concepts and the calculations, which have the illusion of certainty and precision, when in fact there is no certainty and no precision whatsoever, have a psychological benefit, so to speak, as well.
Your book is only tangentially about the men who are officially in power, like the presidents and the
right.
people in the State Department and the Defense Department. It's more about the intellectuals and the think tanks.
Yeah, it's really examining. I mean, you know, presidents have lots of things to do. A president of the United States doesn't know the details of the nuclear war plan or the fine subtleties of deterrence theory and so forth, and neither do most elected officials. But it's really left to the people who have been studying these issues for some years. And so what I've tried to do in the book is to examine a sort of hidden culture in American society that over the last couple of decades, anyway, has emerged as sort of a hidden elite in the center of American power politics.
The first think tank for nuclear strategy was the RAND Corporation, which was started in 1946.
Right.
What's the background of that?
Well, it was the World War II was coming to an end. The chief of the Army Air Force, General Hap Arnold, who was enthusiastic about modern weapons and foresaw the day of intercontinental warfare, saw that a lot of the scientists who had been very helpful during the war in devising radar, various navigational devices, as well as the atomic bomb, would probably be going back into academics or industry, more lucrative professions, and figured out that, you know, he thought World War III was well nigh around the corner, and he wanted to maintain these scientists. So he decided to set up an institute or something, a project that would retain these scientists, keep their access open to classified information, yet give them enough money and independence so they won't be lured away by these other temptations during peacetime. So was started Project RAND, which later became the RAND Corporation, funded entirely at that time by the Air Force. The idea, it started out mainly with physicists and engineers who, one of the very first RAND project was to study the feasibility of what was called an Earth-circling spaceship, which we now call a satellite. And they looked into various technical issues. By the late 40s, there was also a social science and an economics division, and those people started getting into the business of how you might go about both preventing a nuclear war and fighting a nuclear war if it cannot be prevented. And that's that group, that sort of clique, is the group that I'm analyzing in my book, and how they developed their ideas and rose to positions of power.
What channels of communication did RAND have to the government?
Well, it was a think tank that originally was funded entirely by the Air Force. Hap Arnold had some extra R&D money left over at the end of the war. That's how he started it. Later, it also did some work for the Atomic Energy Commission. And now, for the past 15 years or so, RAND does work on all sorts of areas, not just defense. But for many, many years, it was just defense and almost entirely just Air Force.
Did other think tanks become formed, modeled on the RAND Corporation?
Yeah, the Navy started one and the Army started one. And you know, they served their masters. Some people think that I'm being facetious when I say this, but I'm not. I think that the evolution of American nuclear strategy, and to a large degree the evolution of the arms race, at least the American side of it, is at least as much a consequence of the rivalry between the U.S. Air Force and the U.S. Navy as it is the rivalry between the United States and the Soviet Union. And in that rivalry, which was especially during the 50s incredibly intense, RAND, in coming up with these ideas, was basically serving its master, the Air Force.
Could you explain how that rivalry affected
right.
the
well,
arms race?
For example, part of it was independent. There was a group, let me just talk about the war plan of the 40s and the 50s. The U.S. war plan in that period was that if U.S. and Soviet troops clashed anywhere directly, you know, just ground troops, but if they clashed directly, the U.S. war plan approved by the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the President of the United States was to fire off our entire atomic arsenal at all targets, military and civilian, as quickly as possible in the Soviet Union, Red China, and Eastern Europe. In the late 1950s, it was calculated that such an attack would kill about 285 million people who happened to live under communist rule, as well as a few million people in places like Japan and South Korea and West Berlin, which would suffer the effects of fallout. That was not a result of a retaliation. Soviet Union launches a strike against the U.S., we strike back. No, this was just ground troops fighting it out anywhere in the world. Some of these people at the RAND Corporation, who were mainly civilians, thought that this was just ludicrous. It was first, it was out of proportion. But more important, the Soviet Union was beginning to acquire its own nuclear arsenal. If we bombarded their cities, they would almost certainly retaliate and bombard ours. So they saw that this policy was, in fact, suicidal. Now, these people were cold warriors. I mean, there was a cold war going on. There weren't very many people who thought about these things back then who were not cold warriors. They thought that war with the Soviet Union over the next decade was not only possible but probable. And they thought that in such an event, nuclear weapons would have to be, might have to be used. And if they were to be used, they wanted to use them in such a way that it would not be suicide. And so they said, let's try to figure out some way to make this whole business rational. Now, I mentioned earlier that most of these people were economists and mathematicians. That's very significant. Mathematicians think in terms of axioms, corollaries, mathematical calculations that mean something, that have a certain degree of precision. Economists have been trained to think, to look at life in terms of rational actors in a marketplace, consumers, sellers, all playing the same game with the same values. So they essentially, almost subconsciously, translated these principles that they'd been taught into the realm of nuclear warfare. I mean, I've seen recently declassified studies at the RAND Corp, from the RAND Corporation in the late 50s talking about the fighting and deterring of nuclear war between the U.S. and Soviet Union, a couple of hundred pages long, in which most of the pages are filled with game theory matrices, with numbers inside them, you know, just as if the Soviet Union were just, you know, if we were X and they were O in a tic-tac-toe game, or we were black and they were white in a chess game, with, you know, without anything pertaining to what the Soviet Union is as a country, or what people, how people really behave in wartime, how things go wrong. It was just almost an elegant sort of mathematical precision to it. So at about this same time, well, the RAND people wanted to make it rational, so they came up with something called counterforce. And the idea was that if the Soviets, say, invade Western Europe, we would, and we couldn't fight them with conventional weapons, we would launch an attack, nuclear attack, just against Soviet military targets. And then we would keep a protected reserve, hold it back, say to the Soviets, surrender, or else we're going to pick off your cities one by one with this reserve force, which you can't hit. The theory was that the Soviet Union, you know, perceiving this signal, precisely, either would surrender, or if they did retaliate, they would retaliate only against our military forces, because if they hit our cities, we would hit their cities, and they wouldn't do that because that's suicide. You know, it assumed that the Kremlin thought about these things in the same way that the RAND Corporation did. Now, initially, the Air Force staff officers looking at this theory thought, quite rightly, I think, that this was sort of ludicrous, that, you know, these bombs were really too big to be that discriminate, and people really didn't behave this way in wartime. But then, by the late 50s, something spectacular happened, a very threatening, ominous occurrence. The U.S. Navy was coming up with the Polaris submarine. Now, the great thing about the Polaris submarine, and to the Air Force, the greatly terrifying thing about it, was that it could move around underwater, unseen, and it could fire off missiles that could hit cities just as proficiently as Air Force bombers could. And they had an advantage because people were beginning to see by the late 50s that Air Force bomber bases were becoming vulnerable to attack. The submarines wouldn't be vulnerable to attack. However, there was one thing that these submarine missiles couldn't do. they were too inaccurate to destroy military targets without also hitting cities. So here is one thing that SAC, the Strategic Air Command, which was part of the Air Force, could do that the Navy couldn't. It could do the counterforce strike. And so, reversing its position of just a couple of years earlier, the Air Force adopted counterforce as its official policy, mainly as a way of beating back the threat by the Navy. And in fact, it worked both ways. The Navy came up with the Polaris. I had an Air Force general who was a leading staff officer at the time told me that one of his Navy friends around this time said, "We're coming up with something that's going to put you guys out of business." And that was the Polaris. I mean, that's why the Navy, in the 50s, nuclear weapons was where the money was. And the Navy and the Air Force were locked in mortal combat over the limited resources for this.
You see the arms race in a way as a way to keep the different parts of our military in high budgets. The Air Force wanted weapons that would fund them, and Navy wanted weapons that would keep them funded.
Right, and if the Navy won the Navy was coming up with arguments saying, "Oh, listen, all we need to do is to destroy, the Soviet major cities in a retaliatory strike. That doesn't require very many weapons. Also, let's keep them invulnerable. So let's get rid of SAC and let's just put it all in the Polaris." And this was, I mean, there are documents that I have that have been declassified. Memoranda from the commander of SAC to the Air Force Chief of Staff, genuinely worrying about this prospect and what are we going to do about it. And then these ideas from Rand about counterforce happened to come along at the right time at the right place. And in fact, the person who wrote one of the more eloquent documents, a briefing actually on counterforce, a man who was at Rand named William Kaufman, the initial memo that he wrote to the Air Force Chief of Staff about counterforce was entitled The Puzzle of Polaris, which is revealing. I mean, that's what really the subject at hand was.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Fred Kaplan. And he's written a new book called The Wizards of Armageddon. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And it's about the men in the think tanks that have helped form nuclear warfighting strategy. Someone named Brody, whose first name I forget.
Bernard Brody.
Yes, yeah. who was one of the early RAND members, said that he thinks the job of military planners is not to win war, but to prevent war, because you couldn't really think about war in the same terms once there was nuclear weapons. Is there a point where that, you think, started to shift in terms of winning?
Yeah, it shifted even with Brody. I mean, Brody wrote this essay called The Absolute Weapon in 1946, just months after Nagasaki. And it's a remarkably perceptive essay for being so early. He said basically what you said. Look, deterrence is really what's important now. The twin facts of the matter are that the atomic bomb exists and its destructive power is immense. And he said the basic military policy should be to prevent nuclear war, and the way you do that is to get is to have a second strike retaliatory capability, and to keep the nuclear weapons safeguarded from attack, keep them away from logical targets, keep them protected, and use them only in response, and try to prevent the other side from hitting them by making them, you know, very, very protected. However, even by the early 50s, Brody, who served as a brief time as a consultant to the Air Force Chief of Staff, began to say, well, wait a minute, you know, war is possible. What if war does happen? Do we just want to strike back at the enemy cities? And in fact, this idea of counterforce, or at least of not hitting the other guy's cities because he's likely to hit your cities in retaliation, was originated with Brody in 1951. And in fact, when he went to the RAND Corporation later that year, he introduced the idea to other analysts at RAND. Now, the interesting thing about Brody is that much later in the 60s, he came to the conclusion that that all of that was really impossible, that the theory was nice in theory, but impossible to carry out in practice. And so he became really rather dejected and sort of gloomy about the whole topic, and in fact became sort of a pariah among many of his former colleagues. He dropped out. He died of cancer in 1978, but some of his last essays were really quite eloquent on the saying that, look, this whole business about having nuclear options and flexibility is really playing with words, that in the beginning we thought that this was a field of very rigid thinking, and if only we expanded our ideas about how to deal with a weapon, we could deal with it. But in fact, it's not the thinking that's rigid, it's the reality. And that he came to the conclusion that nuclear strategy might really be a contradiction in terms.
Have you ever done any point-by-point comparisons between what the think tanks were telling the presidential administration of the time, what the administration was doing, and what the administration was telling the public?
Uh-huh. Well, there was one brief time when all of that sort of lined up. When John Kennedy was elected president in 1960 and came to office in 61, he appointed Robert McNamara as the Secretary of Defense. And McNamara was a very, you know, prided himself on being a rather cold-blooded sort of thinker himself. And he happened to hire, as some of his whiz kids, some people from RAND. And the people from RAND introduced him to the idea of counterforce. And just before he was introduced to the idea of counterforce, he had gone to SAC headquarters and heard a briefing about the war plan, you know, the all-out, kill everything, shoot everybody, bomb everybody war plan, and was utterly appalled. That there's one story that at one point in this briefing that McNamara was hearing, it was pointed out that Albania, a very tiny country, which even at that early date had dissociated itself remarkably from the politics of the Soviet Union, would be part of the war plan was to completely obliterate Albania because they had a rather huge air defense radar. And, you know, McNamara was appalled by the whole war plan. But as they were leaving, General Tommy Power, who was the commander of the Strategic Air Command, turned to McNamara and said in sort of a humorous manner, "Well, Mr. Secretary, I hope that you don't have any friends or relations in Albania because we're just going to have to bomb it out of existence." And, you know, it was that kind of attitude that just appalled McNamara. So he saw some appeal in this counterforce business. And in fact, in the first 2 years of office, McNamara and his assistants in public speeches, congressional hearings, and so forth, were quite open that this was the policy. They explained it quite explicitly. However, by that time, the Air Force was finding another reason to love counterforce, and that was that it could justify however as many weapons as they wanted. If all you're doing is destroying the other guy's cities, you know, there's only so many square miles in a city, and that only takes so many bombs, and once you have that many, you really don't need any more. But with counterforce, you know, you can define things as military targets as long as you want. Well, that highway could be a logistics road, this air base, they could put bombers there. And if our military buildup provokes the Soviet Union to build up, so much the better, because each weapon that they have becomes another target to the United States, requiring still more weapons for the United States. So an arms race was very much in the Air Force's interest. McNamara wanted to put the clamps on the Joint Chiefs of Staff appetite for more and more weapons. And so in 1963, or really 1964, finally declared an end to counterforce as a public doctrine and started talking about mutual assured destruction, which said we need only enough weapons so that if the Soviets strike us, we can strike them back and destroy their cities. However, and McNamara knew this, the real U.S. nuclear targeting plan remained counterforce and has remained so to this day. In fact, you were talking earlier about the protracted nuclear war plan written, you know, in part by Dr. E. Clay, for the Reagan administration. It really is sort of a refinement on a policy that has secretly been in existence for quite a long time. The great virtue of the Reagan administration, in one sense, is that at least early on, they were very open about it. In the last couple of decades, the nuclear strategists and the people in power have learned how to use this vocabulary so that they'll say, well, they'll talk in some of the ways that Dr. E. Clay was talking in this interview now. They'll talk about the need for flexible options and selective response and the ability to limit damage and, you know, that sort of thing. All that really means, that's exactly synonymous with fighting a limited war, fighting a protracted nuclear war, trying to win a nuclear war. But the great thing about the Reagan administration in the first year was that they weren't smooth enough to know the vocabulary. So, you know, George Bush would say in an interview, "Yeah, I think it's possible to win a nuclear war." Or, you know, Alexander Haig would utter something about a demonstration attack over the plains of Western Europe. And that's what really got people excited. They said, "Jesus, is this really what this has been all about all these years?" And the initial news stories on all of this were sort of misleading, the idea that this is a grand departure from, you know, a policy of mutual assured destruction. In fact, mutual assured destruction all along has been what was kind of a bureaucratic tool uttered by McNamara to put the blitz on the Air Force in arguing for funds up against the President of the United States. The real policy all along has been essentially what it is today.
Yeah, well, Dr. E. Clay in the interview that we just heard said that he saw our official nuclear doctrine as being one of deterrence. And you're saying now that that's maybe what's being presented
to the
public.
Well, but see, deterrence, these words can be used in a broad sense. These people would argue, as the original advocates of counterforce argued, that in order to deter, you must have a war-fighting strategy. They don't talk about this so openly now, but if you look at some of the early statements by Weinberger, he says this quite clearly, that just deterring alone, you know, just first they set up a straw man. They say in the past we've had this policy to just destroy the other side's cities if he attacks us. That's not good enough anymore. We have to have an ability to do what they can do to us and to wage a protracted war. And they will say that the Soviet Union isn't really deterred unless we can fight a war. So whereas most people who think about this in, you know, kind of a every month basis instead of an everyday basis say, oh, well, there are two different kinds of thinking, deterring and war fighting. These people have blurred that whole distinction and can say that our policy is deterrence only because they've convinced themselves that the only really good deterring policy is a war fighting policy. So that they can play around with the language like that. I'm not saying that, one thing is worth pointing out. The whole counterforce strategy from the beginning has been predicated on the United States using nuclear weapons first. Now, a person like Dr. E. Clay would say, no, it is our policy never to have a first strike. But see, they make a distinction between first strike and first use. First use, you see, is where, say, the Soviets invade Western Europe or invade some other vital territory, and we have to use nuclear weapons first. That, to their mind, is not a first strike. That's first use. So any time you read that the Secretary of Defense is, or somebody else is, denying that we have a first strike policy, they're not exactly addressing the issue. What they're saying is, yeah, we're not going to bomb the Soviet Union, bolt from the blue attack. However, they are in no way denying. In fact, the United States has always made it very clear that we are not adopting a no first use policy.
So we might be the first ones to use nuclear weapons,
yeah,
but we'd
fact,
only use it if we were wronged by
another country. That's right. And in fact, some of the weapons that we're building today make no sense unless we were going first. For example, the MX missile, which is in a fixed silo, which presumably is vulnerable to an attack, and yet it has the ability to destroy Soviet missiles in their silos. You know, why would you build such a weapon unless which is vulnerable to their attack unless you were planning on using it first?
We now have several think tanks planning nuclear warfighting strategies, and part of the rationale for planning these strategies is so that they will serve as a deterrent, since we have it so well figured out. That would
That's
be
right.
a deterrent against dropping a bomb on us. But do you think having all these alternate ways of fighting a nuclear war makes it any more possible for us to fight it since the plans are written?
Yeah, no, I don't think so. But see, I think the real danger is that they might be deluding themselves into thinking that because these studies have been around for so long and I can do these calculations on a piece of paper or on a slide rule, and that they talk about it so glibly that, you know, they come to think that they can. And, you know, and in some ways, in some ways he wasn't, but in some ways Curtis LeMay was right. These guys who talk about you know, controlling the use of these the force of these weapons and trying to do little tit-for-tat strikes with nuclear weapons are really kidding themselves, that these weapons are monsters with very powerful, capabilities and consequences. And you're really kidding yourself if you think that you can control the pace and rhythm and flow of warfare once you get it underway.
Fred Kaplan is my guest. He's the author of a new book called The Wizards of Armageddon, and it's about the people in the think tanks who have helped develop nuclear warfighting strategy. In your studies of the different decades since the 1940s when two bombs were dropped, how aware do you think the presidents of America have been about the capabilities of nuclear weapons, and how fully have they comprehended what the people who you describe as defense intellectuals have planned, since the people in the think tanks have devoted their lives to studying this, and nobody like a president who's a generalist could know quite as much as the specialists do.
Yeah, that's right, and the specialists sort of depend on that. Every time a president comes into office, and usually every year, he gets a briefing, a net assessment briefing. What do we have? What do they have? What are the effects of nuclear bombs and nuclear war? And what the threat is and what we can do, what they can do. And that's about it. I think Carter was the first president to actually go up in the airborne command post, the airplane, the kneecap, as they call it, which a president would sit, after he's evacuated in case of nuclear war. Carter took a very detailed interest in a lot of this stuff. In fact, probably more detailed than maybe there are stories that at one point Carter was, fancying himself the engineer, was looking at the engineering blueprints of a military reconnaissance satellite. You know, he really got into it in a very major way. But someone like Reagan, for example, I'm quite sure wouldn't be able to get to first base in discussing these kinds of concepts. Hasn't got the slightest idea what these weapons are all about. You might remember at his press conference in October of 1981, in which he announced his 5-point strategic program, he was asked a simple question, a real softball question, about the window of vulnerability, whether it existed now or whether it will exist in the future. And he started talking about vulnerabilities on the Western Front. And, I mean, he was clear that he didn't have the slightest idea what the window of vulnerability was, or what it referred to, or whether it existed now or in the past or in the future, and sort of finally turned over all these really simple questions to Cap Weinberger, who was there to answer very technical questions. This is sort of a continuous elite. And I'm not suggesting, some grand conspiracy here, but these are the people who have fashioned themselves as the experts. And some of them get into government positions and sort of bring their brethren along with them. And it's not that, this is some kind of, I'm not a Council on Foreign Relations or Trilateral Commission or something, some nonsense like that. It's just that these are the people who have fashioned themselves as the experts and who have been accepted as the experts, who have been around for a long, long time, who are still there, and who, therefore, whose ideas have consequence, especially in a field where people who are not experts consider that it's hopelessly beyond their own capacities to deal with these problems.
In your research, did you discover any periods in which American presidents were close to using a nuclear bomb that the public didn't know about?
Yeah. Most people point to the Cuban Missile Crisis of 62, but I think a far more serious case was the Berlin Crisis of 61. And this is a story that I think has really never been told before, at least the part that I'll get to after laying up the introduction. The Berlin crisis was a very serious business. In 1961, first year Kennedy's in office, Khrushchev threatens to sign a separate peace treaty with East Germany by the end of the year, putting all of Berlin, including West Berlin, under East German sovereignty. Therefore, if the West tries to treat West Berlin as some kind of protectorate of the West, it would be a violation of sovereignty and therefore a cause of war. And Khrushchev makes a very big deal out of this. This was before the major conventional force buildup, non-nuclear military buildup of the United States. It was thought that it would be practically impossible for the U.S. Army to, say, mount an invasion of East Germany and to occupy West Berlin, which is deep inside East Germany, against Soviet and Warsaw Pact resistance. So at very high levels in the White House and the Pentagon, people started thinking about using nuclear weapons, trying to come up with some magical option. Because at the time, the war plan was still in effect, the kill everybody, shoot everything off war plan. At about the same time, we were getting back the first data, stream of data from reconnaissance satellites, which aided tremendously in telling us just what the Soviet Union really had. Up until this time, the US Air Force intelligence was telling everybody that the Soviet Union by the end of 61 would have about 500 ICBMs, land-based intercontinental ballistic missiles. It turned out that they only had four, not 400, but four. It also turned out that they weren't even loaded with warheads. It would take several hours to put warheads on them. None of their bombers were on alert. Almost none of their submarines were in the ocean. Those that were would have to surface before firing. And moreover, their air defenses, you know, surface-to-air missiles, didn't work at all. Their radar was terrible. We really couldn't. They really couldn't shoot down a bomber of ours if the flight tactics were proper. And so people started thinking, this is our option. This maybe this first strike counterforce option. And this was being looked at by a lot of people in the Kennedy administration who had come from the RAND Corporation. Maybe this will work. And Kennedy ordered a study that was eventually signed by McNamara with only five names on it. It was written by a high-ranking Pentagon official named Henry Rowan, who's now the director of estimates of the CIA, along with Carl Kazin of the National Security Council. And it concluded that, yes, we could launch a disarming first strike against the Soviet Union and knock out most of their arsenal with very high confidence. Now, there was one caveat to all of this, and that was that the study also showed that some Soviet weapons would almost certainly survive. And if the Soviets retaliated with those weapons, they could kill at least 2 million and maybe as many as 10 or even 15 million Americans. At that point, the discussion stopped. Now, it's interesting to point out that back at the RAND Corporation, such a study would have been looked upon as just being ingenious. Herman Kahn, who was at the RAND Corporation, once getting into a conversation with somebody about a counterforce attack, and the person said, oh, well, but 10 million people would be killed. He said, no, you're missing the point. It's only 10 million people. There's a big difference between 10 million dead on the one hand and 100 million dead on the other hand. It's kind of the speed at which he would talk. And also it would be assumed that, you know, this would be nuclear blackmail against the Soviet Union. They wouldn't dare respond because we would have this reserve force with which, you know, that whole business. But in the real world, with real leaders facing the prospect of real war and real fatalities, said no, this was just an unacceptable option. Now, another interesting thing to point out here is that one of the officials most adamantly opposed to doing anything about exploiting this strategic superiority that we had was Paul Nitze, who at the time was an assistant secretary of defense. Later on, Paul Nitze became a big thinker in the Committee on the Present Danger and is now in the Reagan administration. While in the Committee on the Present Danger, Nitze popularized sort of a reverse mirror image scenario of the counterforce plan, which had the Soviet Union knocking out our land-based missiles. We would not use our submarine-based missiles to retaliate because they could only hit cities. We wouldn't hit their cities because the Soviet Union would then hit our cities. Therefore, we would be checkmated, so to speak. But in the mid-70s, when Nitze was writing that, the United States could have responded with, even at the worst case, about 4,000 nuclear warheads. Back in 1961, when Paul Nitze said, no, 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 we can't take advantage of this superiority, the Soviet Union could respond with, at the most, maybe a dozen nuclear bombs. I think, you know, the story carries a very revealing message, which is that, you know, if the United States, there might be a great difference between the United States and the Soviet Union in terms of what are acceptable losses and unacceptable losses. However, if the United States is unwilling to take the nuclear risk, to throw the cosmic dice, because the Soviets might end up with a dozen nuclear weapons after the attack, I seriously doubt that the Soviets would be tempted to throw the same set of dice, knowing that the United States would end up with about 4,000 nuclear weapons.
So you think fear, mutual fear, has been our greatest tool in preventing nuclear war so far?
Yeah, but I also think that message points up to the fact that we really don't need as many nuclear weapons as a lot of people say, and that the kind of fine-tuned calculations on which nuclear weapons requirements are based have no basis in reality. They're really this kind of ethereal, abstract universe that's rather divorced from real people and real politics and real awareness of the damage that these weapons can do.
It's really hard for lay people to make sense of a lot of the nuclear strategist talk, mm-hmm. as we were discussing earlier. And it's also hard to get access to the real information that they're working with. A lot of it is confidential. How much do you think the public should know about in terms of what our fighting strategy is? And I mean, I would understand that there are reasons that we wouldn't want all this information to be out. We wouldn't want our enemies or potential enemies to know exactly what our options were.
Well, I would say, you know, there are different levels. Things that should remain absolutely classified would be things like the movements of our submarines, okay? That kind of thing, you know. If somebody leaked me that information and, you know, it would make a tremendous front page story, that's the kind of thing that I just would not print, okay, and would probably destroy as quickly as I could. Things at a slightly less damaging level would be things like the precise nature of the war plan, you know, like exactly what targets are going to be hit when, what the command control procedures are, that sort of thing. But really, I think a lot of this is really not as secret. There's no reason to keep a lot of this stuff classified. I mean, the Soviets probably know it already anyway. You know, it's like during the Vietnam War, when we were secretly bombing Cambodia, that was classified. The Cambodians certainly knew that we were bombing Cambodia. The North Vietnamese certainly knew we were bombing Cambodia. The Viet Cong certainly did. It was only the American people, and in an interesting way, in that context, much of the American military command that didn't know. And there was a reason for that. And I think that the more that this information remains classified, the more mystique it has. And the more people say, well, I don't know what's going on. This guy has the classified information. He knows what's going on. I'm going to try. I have no choice but to defer to him. So the classified system, well, you know, much of the information should remain classified, but much of it, there's really no reason for it. And it's basically designed, I think, even deliberately to keep this kind of a closed universe.
You share something with the people who you've been studying, and that is a tremendous knowledge of nuclear doctrine and a total immersion in it, because you did a lot of research to write this book and you continue to do research because you're still reporting on nuclear issues for the Globe as well as other publications. You talked before about how this immersion you feel leaves the planners kind of insensitive to the reality mm-hmm. of nuclear weapons. What has it done to you emotionally?
Well, I mean, I sort of know that. I mean, I sort of know this because I have been through it. I mean, I went to graduate school and studied this stuff, and I was a congressman's aide for a couple of years. And you going through that experience, you do learn to talk and think the way that these guys talk and think. And, you know, since I think about this stuff probably almost as much as these guys do, though in a slightly different way and in a completely different context, I guess that I've had to desensitize myself to it somewhat as well. I think one difference is that, you know, I almost deliberately re-immerse myself, and I read about other things as well and have wide interests. But even in this field, you know, you have to keep pinching yourself that, hey, this stuff is really, you know, horrendous stuff to deal with, and don't let yourself get carried away with these calculations which really don't mean anything. I think the difference is that these people are in positions where they have no incentive to say that to themselves.
We have about 2 minutes left. Do you think you could give us a brief who's who of who's in power now in terms of nuclear strategy, their connections are to the past?
Yeah. Well, the main people, for example, let's talk about this defense guidance document that you quoted to Dr. E. Clay, the one which talked about protracted nuclear war. That was authored essentially by Dr. E. Clay, who's Undersecretary of Defense for Policy and goes back to the RAND Corporation, a man named Andrew Marshall, who is a real behind-the-scenes guy. He's the director of an obscure office in the Pentagon called Net Assessment, but he's been through five administrations, very powerful guy. He goes back to the Rand Corporation from the early 50s. And perhaps most of all, a man named Richard Perle, who's Assistant Secretary for International Security Policy, who didn't come from Rand, but who learned his first lessons in strategy when he was dating the daughter of a man named Albert Wallstetter, who is one of the leading intellectual figures at the Rand Corporation, and sort of got his first teachings on strategy sitting around Albert's pool as Albert pontificated to the young Richard. And Perle later went on to become an aide to Henry Jackson, a fierce opponent of all arms control agreements. He is now the man in the Pentagon who is the most powerful person in the Pentagon dealing with arms control and strategic arms policy matters, and is perhaps even more than Marshall and Eclay, very fierce in his views about the Soviet Union, very opposed to any kind of serious arms control, and perhaps even more naively believing in the power of these kinds of calculations and scenarios in predicting what will really happen in a nuclear war. There are officers, colonels in the Joint Chiefs of Staff lower levels who literally fear Richard Perle as a man who, because of his inexperience with war and his preoccupation with calculations, might get us involved in something someday. I've had colonels tell me that they think Perle is a very dangerous man.
What reaction have you gotten from nuclear strategists to your new book?
Indirect. I mean, they don't tell me, but I hear that they've told somebody. The basic, if I can tip my hat to myself, the basic reaction is, well, I didn't agree with some of the interpretation, but I don't see anything factually wrong with it.
I want to thank you for joining us. It's been a very interesting 50 minutes, I think it was.
Thanks
a lot for being here.
Thanks very much.
My guest has been Fred Kaplan, and he's written a new book called The Wizards of Armageddon, and it's about the people in the think tanks who, since 1946, have played an important role in planning nuclear weapons strategy in America. This new book, The Wizards of Armageddon, has just been published by Simon & Schuster. Fred Kaplan writes about defense issues for several publications, including the Boston Globe, for whom he's a regular contributor, and he wrote a major article for their 1982 magazine section on nuclear planning and peace and war in the nuclear age, and that section won a Pulitzer Prize in 1982. Well, that's about it for this afternoon's Fresh Air. I'll tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on the show in just a minute, but let's check in with shadow traffic first.
Good afternoon, everyone. Major highways in Philadelphia in excellent shape. No major delays being reported on the Schuylkill Expressway or I-95. Roosevelt Extension northbound looks fine as you travel through the detour. Hunting Park slow between Wissahickon and Broad. SEPTA's Chestnut Hill East Line in and out of Reading Terminal. 10 to 15-minute delays due to track work going on between Stenton and Chestnut Hill stations. That track work will be going on indefinitely. The Tacony-Palmyra Bridge scheduling an opening about 8 o'clock. And if you're traveling into New Jersey, Ben Franklin and Walt Whitman Bridges in very good shape. And that's shadow traffic for WHY. Y91 FM, this is John Brown.
That Shadow Traffic Report was funded with a grant from Atari Video Games and Cartridges. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, I'll speak with medical writer Rennie Witt, who's the author of a new book called PMS, What Every Woman Should Know About Premenstrual Syndrome. We'll be discussing premenstrual syndrome and some of the what she feels is misinformation surrounding its effects on women. And we'll also discuss the subject of her earlier book, which is about teenage pregnancy. At 4 o'clock, the American Prose series continues with an interview with Robert Stone, the author of The Dog Soldiers, on which the film Who'll Stop the Rain was based, and his latest book is called A Flag for Sunrise. He'll be reading a short story titled Aquarius Obscured and discussing the religious and political themes in his work. So that's all coming up tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air. If you have any questions or comments about the show, we hope you'll write to us. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's WHYY Radio, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. Abby Ginsberg contributed editing assistance to today's show. Maeve McGoran is the production assistant. Danny Miller, the co-producer of the program. Joyce Lieberman was the technical director. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening, and hope you have a great evening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nina Totenberg.
And this is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
Aquino and Marcus were not that different before martial law. They came out of the same social-cultural elite. They shared in worldviews that made them rivals but not political opponents.
Although President Marcos kept his political opponent in solitary confinement for years, opposition leader Aquino never lost faith in peaceful political change and continued to oppose revolution.
That story tonight on All Things Considered. Also, paraquat spraying. Is it really a danger to your health?
Job security at AT&T.
And 600 versions of Louie Louie on a California radio station.
First, we have this news update.
This is Brian Naylor. Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos today denied his regime had any part in the assassination of Benigno Aquino, who was gunned down yesterday minutes after he returned from self-exile in the U.S. Marcos told Philippine reporters that the killing was, quote, a communist rub-out job. Earlier today, a 12-party political alliance called for a peaceful campaign against the Marcos government, focusing demands for democratic reforms. The identity of the lone attacker who apparently shot Aquino has still not been determined. However, U.S. State Department spokesman Alan Romberg says the assassination does not appear to have been the work of Philippine military police.
You know, it's a little early to talk about specifically what happened. As I say, our reporting from our embassy, which has looked into this, been in touch with various people, indicates that the reports which were on the in the news yesterday, that the security guards, several security guards shot Mr. Aquino. So that reporting seems to be erroneous.
Thousands of weeping Filipinos today filed past the open casket of Aquino at his former home. Aquino's family, now living in exile, is to leave the Boston area for Manila later today. The White House reiterated that it does not plan to change President Reagan's scheduled visit to the Philippines in wake of the assassination. However, Mr. Reagan indicated today that plans for the November trip may still be up in the air. Heavy shelling of Christian neighborhoods near Beirut Airport caused at least 6 deaths today. Syrian forces and Druze militiamen charged that Lebanese army guns near the airport were pounding Druze villages, and they threatened to close the airport again if the shelling didn't stop. Shells exploded near the president.